I'm Ruth Gregory, and in the next 3 weeks, we're going to be going over different aspects of gravity. So you've already had an introductory gravity course, and the idea of this course is to take a couple of steps back initially and to go over the basics of general relativity again, but from a different standpoint to when you first meet it. So this first week is going to be a little more mathematical. So we're going to look at the sort of formalism behind gravity and general relativity. So gravity is actually a kind of a strange force. In fact, it's almost even not a force in the sense that we describe gravity by saying that every particle or every sort of massive object, or indeed massless, massless particle, moves locally in a straight line, unless there's some other more sort of standard force acting on it. And so gravity's really saying that if things are moving together or appear to be attracted, it's simply saying that space is curved. And so to describe gravity, at least according to general relativity, we have to know how to describe curved space-time. And so in mathematics, that's called geometry or differential geometry. So that's what we're going to do rather quickly and certainly extremely uncleanly from a pure mathematical perspective. But the idea behind looking at the maths of differential geometry is that you build up an understanding of how curved space works, an understanding of what geometry is, and therefore you get a slightly different perspective on gravity and gravitational physics. So I'm going to start by just laying out what my conventions are, because there are always sort of slightly different sets of conventions. So for the metric, I'm going to take a mostly minus signature. And so that's possibly different from the first course you had on general relativity. And I guess the rationale behind that is that one of the very special things about relativity in general is it's this idea of causality. Causality is extremely fundamental from the perspective of special and general relativity. And so this particular choice leaves time-like intervals positive, but it is only a choice. Another place where there's a choice of how you define something is in the Riemann tensor. So I think this is by now a reasonably standard convention, but again, sometimes you'll see the C and D reversed. So that's the convention for the Riemann tensor. And then the Ricci tensor is the contraction of the Riemann tensor on the first and third indices. I'm also going to set H bar and C to 1 simply to keep, well, I think setting C equals 1 is fairly obvious with relativity, but setting H bar equal to 1 is simply because I just want one physical dimension left, and so my Newton's constant is going to be actually dimensionful. So I don't want to completely remove dimensions. I don't want to go to a set of units which are the Planck units, particularly because I'm going to be talking about extra dimensions later on. And one of the interesting features about extra dimensions is that you see that the Newton's constant is no longer some fundamental natural constant, but it's derived essentially from properties of the way that you reduce from higher dimensions to lower dimensions. So it's a derived rather than fundamental quantity. And then it's quite useful, I think, also to keep you honest about your dimensions. It's quite useful to have at least one dimension left in your equation so you can check bidimensional analysis if you've got them right. So, as I say, you've already met basic relativity, so I'm going to probably, hopefully, give you all the relevant details, but be a reasonably rapid review. Okay, so gravity's about curved space. So the first thing that we have to decide is what we mean by curved space. So the way that mathematicians think about curved space is to say, well, to formalize our intuitive notion of what curvature means. So our simple examples of things that we think of as curved are things like the surface of the Earth. So that's a two-sphere. So we would think of that as something that was curved. So how do we know it's curved? Well, basically, we've got a sort of obvious horizon. If we go higher up, we can start to sort of detect curvature of the Earth. I guess I'm thinking about very high in terms of going up in some sort of either spacecraft or sort of a powerful jet. But nonetheless, we can actually see or perceive that the Earth is curved, yet for a long time, many people thought the Earth was flat. So why is that? That's because if we look around us here and now, things don't really look very curved. If we draw parallel lines, then within the precision with which we can draw parallel lines, they look as if they're going to stay parallel. And so this idea of curvature is something which tends to manifest itself on larger scales. And so in mathematics, this is formalized in the concept of a manifold. So the difference with a mathematical definition is I'm going to call it a set of events, because from our perspective, what is space-time but something that happens at a particular place, at a particular time, or an event? And so what characterizes our manifold? Well, first of all, we know it's got to look locally flat. So what do we mean by that? I'm saying it looks locally like Rn. So this is our manifold here. This blob is meant to represent our manifold. And I draw a copy of Rn here. Then we have to say that if we look in at some region here, it's going to look locally like some region here. And so what that actually means is that we take a little sort of space here that we can map it into this copy of Rn, and we can think of that map as giving us a set of coordinates. So it's giving us some x, y, z, for example, if n was 3. And so the other thing that we need to know is how do we get our whole manifold? So we want our manifold to be represented as a union if each of these little sort of patches is called a chart. And so the idea is we can cover our manifold with lots of little patches, each of which have a mapping down, their own little mapping down, into R to the N. So this U alpha here might go to there, and that might be Y, a different set of coordinates. So this is sort of getting the idea that our manifold can be represented as lots of little little charts, coordinate charts. This whole sort of set of charts is called an atlas. And if we have an overlap, and this is where what the sort of something very specific to what we want, if we have an overlap of charts, say between this alpha and beta here, it means we've got two choices. We can go down into our locally flat space in two different ways. We can either use X or we can use Y. And so if I look at this overlap here, down in my flat space, then the transformation between the X and the Y had better be well defined. And in fact, we're going to ask that it is infinitely differentiable. So it's a sensible, so you've got x mu of y nu, all of the partial derivatives exist, and you can differentiate them infinitely often. So this gives us what we call a C infinity manifold. So of course, mathematicians think about things where maybe things are only differentiable once, which would be C1. So what we want is something which is nice and smooth, infinitely differentiable. So that's our setup. And so the idea is, what we then do formally is we know all about Rn. That's how we first met vectors. We first met vectors as in R cubed as just an ordered triplet, an x, y, z coordinate. And so we know how to do geometry very well in flat space. And so what we have to do is find a way to just kind of transport that, what we know here, over into this environment. So this is what we're going to do, and the way we're going to do it is we're going to think about what geometrically things are. So what is a vector geometrically? So we're not going to do it by, a vector behaves a certain way under a coordinate transformation. I've told you what the coordinates are, at least from an abstract perspective, but we're not going to use that. We're not going to say, a vector is something which transforms in a certain way. We want to think about what a vector actually means. And so from that perspective, in terms of thinking about R cubed, a much better way to think about a vector in R cubed is not so much as a triplet of numbers, but as an arrow, something with a direction and a magnitude. So we've got to try and get that concept up here. So in order to do that, we've actually got to just take a few steps first. So the first thing that we want to do is to define a function. Everything's going to be C infinity. So a function is going to be a map from our manifold down into the reals, And the idea is it's going to be infinitely differentiable in local coordinates. So I'm always a great one for abbreviations. So that's infinitely, and that's differentiable. And again, there's this idea that we've got here, we've got our manifold, we've got the real line here. The function f is going from the manifold down onto the reals. We've got our copy of Rn. And so we have, this is one of our charts. We can also construct a function from Rn down to the reals simply by going via the flat space using coordinates to go to take us through Rn down into the reals. So that's a C infinity function. And so we have an infinite dimensional vector space of functions on the manifold. So the reason I'm just sort of putting that down is actually a lot of the ways we define or describe things on our manifold end up coming back to the action of something on these functions. So I just had to be clear about what I meant by a C infinity function. Now, let's think a bit more about how we want to get a vector. I said a vector is something with a direction and a length. So how might we get something with a direction and a length? Well, an obvious idea might be to sort of take a tangent to a curve. So let's actually write down what we mean by a curve and then see if taking a tangent to the curve makes sense. So we've done a map from our manifold down into the reals. So what's a curve? Well, it's just some line that kind of wanders around in space. So in other words, that's going to be a map from the reals into the manifold. And again, we're going to say that when we mean an infinitely differentiable curve, what we mean is it's differentiable with respect to the local charts. So here's our manifold, here's the real line. So we've got some interval that we're looking at. And so our curve just takes us from this segment of the real line up into the manifold. We then use our local coordinate frame, so you can see the pattern emerging here, to map this over here to an image of gamma. And so this tells us that we have something which is our standard idea of a curve in terms of flat space. So to define a vector, let's see if we can just take a tangent to that curve. And so if I have a curve gamma, then I'm going to define my tangent vector t in the following way. Now, here, my curve is simply taking me from the real line up into the manifold. But then I can use a function to go back down to the reals. And so what I have at the bottom here, this bit, is simply a normal differentiable function. And so I can take df dt for that function. So that seems like I haven't really done anything. But the point is that this has to be true for every single function that lives in this C infinity of M. And so the fact that, in essence, what I can do here, in a way, it's not meant to be implies, it's just meant to be sort of figuratively, what I'm doing is I'm saying that my tangent vector is d by dt. So if it were only true for a special set of functions, that wouldn't be something that was geometrical and associated with the manifold. It's the fact that no matter what you slot in there in front of this T, it does it for every single function. It always gives you df dt when you transport it down. Think of it in terms of maps or functions. It's the fact that that's true for every single function that tells you this is something beyond just df dt. This is something associated with the manifold. And so you can think of it as just d by dt. So you could also imagine a different curve. I'm sure there's a color here. Let me take another curve. I'm going to label a point where they are going through here as P. This curve, let's say we're going in that direction, has a different tangent vector if this one is parameterized by, say, S. So what you see is that, first of all, if you change your parameterization but have the same path, so maybe you send lambda to 2 lambda or lambda to lambda squared, changing, not lambda, t, sorry, if you take t to 2t, then you will change the length of your tangent vector. So you can see how you can change the length of this object. You can also get a different direction by choosing a different curve. So length, we haven't really got a concept of length yet, so I'm just sort of saying this figuratively. We can multiply t by a constant. So the reason I picked on those two particular operations is, of course, the definition of a vector space is the fact that it's a sort of abelian group under an addition property, the fact that it scales, you can multiply by some real number. And so these here are both kind of encoding those particular properties. And so even though I've not really written anything down in coordinates yet, I've actually defined vectors at, and in fact a vector space at a particular point P. So this vector space has got a name. It's the tangent space at P, and we denote it as TP of M. So it's simply a vector space, and it lives at P. And we can think of it as being somehow tangent to the manifold, because that's how we defined it. So we can do this, obviously, not just at P, but at all points of the manifold. And so here we come to the real distinction between curved and flat geometry. It's the fact that if we do this construction at another place, another point, we actually get a different tangent space. They're going to be, both of them are going to be copies of Rn, so you can relate them. They're not completely different vector spaces, but they're not the same space. So it's like saying that, you know, a plane over here is distinct from a plane over here. You can obviously move that piece of paper back over and get a relation between the two, but unless you're in absolutely flat space, moving this plane across will not, you in general, you won't be able to do that everywhere. So if you're in completely flat space, you can always move two planes together and they always fall on top of each other, and that's always completely, so a completely well-defined thing to do. In a curved space, you might find you can do it over here, but then as you try and sort of spread things out further, something's going to wrinkle. So it's really, again, this analogy of a two-sphere is actually quite a good analogy, because the surface of the Earth, when we want to look at, you know, where we are, if we're doing geography, we'll get, say, an atlas of the world. And so that's all sheets of paper, little pieces of R2, little charts, U alpha. They all cover the Earth, because no point on the Earth doesn't appear in the atlas. However, it's not true that we can simply take that atlas, unwrap it, stitch it together, and form a real sphere. There'll always be a little bit somewhere where we've got to make a little wrinkle or sort of kind of do something that's not quite straight. So the set of all these spaces is called the tangent bundle. And so that's really giving you the notion that every point has one of these tangent spaces, you bundle them together, and that gives you the whole thing for the whole manifold. So, for example, our two-sphere. So if we take our P to be the North Pole, and we look at our tangent space, well, we maybe, let's say we go up to the North Pole from here, from Waterloo, and we get one particular direction at the North Pole. So if instead I choose to go up to the North Pole from Durham, which is where I'm from, then I'll be coming at it from a different direction. And so those two choices give me two different directions, and they span a plane, which would be like a sheet of paper sitting at the North Pole. Yep. Mm-hmm. It does exactly, actually. So I think the thing, so normally what you would be doing when you do, say, like normal 3D vectors, when you first, I guess when they're first introduced, you perhaps introduce them as a set, you know, X, Y, Z, and then draw an arrow from the origin to X, Y, Z. So you introduce them as the line almost, 0P. So, and because everything's flat, this all sort of makes sense. But what you're actually doing there is you're taking the tangent plane of R cubed, based at the origin. So in R cubed, when you draw this type of thing with some point P, and then you draw the vector OP, you would then be saying that this R cubed would actually be T of the origin. That would be that tangent plane. And then you do things like finding tangent vectors of a curve in R cubed. So you might have this vector here. But then you use the fact that it's flat, that there is a sort of sensible way of transporting your, you know, of identifying, connecting all the different tangent spaces in this bundle to say, this vector over here is, in some very real intuitive sense, I call that N, the same as that vector there. So you are transporting it back. So you've done already a course on GR, so you know about parallel transport. And so the fact is that parallel transport in R cubed with a standard metric connection, the standard sort of flat, you know, Pythagorean distance function, you know how to parallel transport back to the origin. And so all of the tangent bundle, all of these copies of R cubed, all at these different places in R cubed, are really all carbon copies of this single original tangent plane whose base is the origin. So in this case, the manifold and the tangent space are identical, and you have a completely well-defined way of transporting vectors all over the plane. Once you've got curvature, as you know, you can no longer uniquely parallel transport vectors around. You go around a curve, and you don't get back to where you started. So this is our tangent plane for the sphere, and our tangent bundle would be the set of all of these tangent planes. So our tangent space, being a vector space, we can write a basis. And so, strictly speaking, we could choose any basis we fancied, but in practice, we tend to see only two sorts of basis in general relativity, or in fact, even in general. So the first one of these, the most common basis, is called a coordinate basis. And it's where we say, I said that we could write our tangent vector as d by dt. Each coordinate function, each x mu, if you say take mu equals 1, that also is giving you a function down from the manifold onto the reals. So it's also giving you a curve, so you can choose d by dx mu. So you can think of that as, say, a curve which is the x-axis, or the, you know, the sort of pre-image of the x-axis in the manifold, and then d by dx would be the tangent vector, and that would be the coordinate basis, first coordinate basis element. So this is the most common basis. But another common basis that we'll use is an orthonormal basis. And I'll denote that EA. And here, this is simply saying that we're going to take a set. We're going to start with E1. We choose E2 orthogonal to E1 in the sense of this underlying Rn. And then we keep picking vectors which are successively orthogonal. So this can also, you might see this as written in that form. So what does it mean by having picked a basis? Well, it means that any vector can be written in terms of this basis. So this is writing a vector with respect to these bases. So we know if we've got a basis, we can decompose any vector with respect to its components along those basis vectors. And so this would be the general expression. In terms of the coordinate basis, it would look like this. And so t mu d by dx mu, you can kind of see how d by dt is simply taking the projection of d by dt along the different coordinate directions. So these elements here, the t mu and the ta, are the components. That's how you're familiar. That's how you're used to writing vectors. So ta or t mu are the components. So these are components with respect to basis and a scalar. So I've got two questions there, yes? Sorry, thanks. Typo. So this is, yeah, because basically T, the vector T, is d by d little t, which is the parameter. And so you can think you can keep that as its own geometric object, or you know that if you had a general function on the manifold, you would be able to see it in terms of its local coordinate chart, f of x mu. And then if you wanted to take the derivative with respect to t, you'd of course take dx mu by dt, df by dx mu. So that's what that is there. So that's, thanks for that. Mm-hmm. So you're using the idea that here you're in a copy of Rn. So you're a copy of just say if it was R cubed, that's a standard standard vector space. So you know what you're locally. Yeah, you're using. So this is nothing to do with the manifold at this point. It's just saying that in terms of a local, a sort of local, well, I was about to say sort of local Euclidean, but of course it depends. If we're doing space-time, it would be a local Lorentzian metric. But at the moment, I'm not saying that that has anything to do with distances on the manifold, just at the moment. So I was simply wanting to introduce the two main bases that we'll be using. And so just a note here about something that might cause confusion as we move on and sort of do some of this geometry from a more mathematical perspective. When you use this geometric notation, T, as I underline it, is meant to be the vector. That is the vector, that's the geometric object. Here, what I've done is I've written it in terms of the basis. So these are now vectors, and these are now just numbers, scalars. So this T mu is not a vector in this context. So this is known as So this is kind of one of these annoying, like, subtle points. It's something called abstract index notation. The concept was, at least I think it was introduced by Roger Penrose. And most of the time, and indeed beyond this first part of the gravitational physics review, most of the time I actually will use T mu as shorthand for a vector. But in this initial geometric bit, it's a set of scalars. And so what that means is, if I'm taking, as I will want to do tomorrow, derivatives of my vector, what I've got to do is I take derivatives of these functions, the components, and then I add on a piece which tells me how my basis changes. So when you're looking at a derivative of a vector, you've got not only how the something is sort of inherently changing, like these components, but you've also got to think how the geometry is changing. So if this sounds confusing, have a look back when you did geometry of R cubed. You probably did not just sort of standard Cartesian basis, but you'll have done a spherical polar type basis. And I'll put good money on the fact that the first time you ever see the spherical basis, you're probably thinking, oh no, what's going on? And it seems very bizarre. But in the spherical polar basis, you take your first vector to be radial, your second vector is the theta direction from north to south pole, and then the final basis vector is the phi direction, the lines of latitude. And so this is an orthonormal basis in this sense, but it's not a constant basis. So it's not something where, you know, the vectors just sort of automatically transport all the way around R cubed. They change as you move around. What you mean by radial direction changes as you're moving around in space. And so when you do derivatives, if you remember when you do grad div curl in a spherical basis, you have to add all sorts of extra pieces. And those extra pieces, as you know now, are the connection components. But what it's saying is that any vector written in that basis has got some part which are the components, which could change, and another part, which is the vector information, which can also change. So eventually, what we found when we have to do calculations in gravity, drawing these sort of distinctions turns out to just be more trouble than it's worth. And so we tend to drop this notion. And what we really mean by T mu is this thing here. So I'll try and, in this first part, be consistent. But if it's if you look and you think something I've written looks a bit weird, just, you know, sort of ask, is that such and such, you know, and I'll say, yes, it's the abstract index notation. So so that's vectors. Covectors, you know that there are basically two sorts of basic beasts on the manifold. So this is our standard vector, which you've noticed the components I've put with an index upstairs. Covectors are defined. As actually maps, which take a vector and map it into the reals. So if omega is a covector, so you might write it as an either Brahn-Ket notation, and that's quite deliberately used because, of course, in quantum mechanics, you're looking at states part of a Hilbert space. It's the same idea. Or you might just see it more written like a function, omega of u. And so here, it's taking a vector, and it's mapping it down into the reals. So in a coordinate basis, So the space of covectors is denoted TP star, and that's the dual. Actually, wait a minute. So it's the dual of the vector space. And so if we have a basis of TP, we can form a dual basis. So I'm going to denote the dual basis by omegas. I think in supergravity literature, you'll usually see, you know, them both denoted by E, with the position of the index telling you whether it's the basis or the dual basis. But that's kind of using the idea that the two are related. So that's also, I guess, assuming that we are actually dealing with a sort of gravitational setup where we have a metric. So here again, we don't need a metric to form the dual space. What is the definition of omega? It's the fact that if you act with omega on the basis vectors, that it'll either give you one or zero. So from this, we can actually see what happens to components. So if we have a vector V, which is going to be VA, EA, and we have some covector mu, keep frequencies. Then if I look at the action or the map mu of V, this is simply mu B VA omega B of EA, but that's just delta AB. And so I end up with a familiar expression, which is saying that I just sum over the components. So let me just, yeah, sorry. Sorry, using what, sorry? Oh, that's probably, that doesn't mean anything. That's stylistic. That's art. Sometimes I feel like drawing, I don't even think, it's because I'm not thinking. I'm just trying to remember to underline things. And I think if I'm rushing, I'm more likely to do a straight line. But if I'm thinking about it, I'm probably more likely to do a wobble. There's no significance at all. It doesn't mean I'm in a bad mood or anything. So sorry about that. Yes. Right. So the reason is there is no GAB at this point. This is actually quite a sort of key comment. This omega is an element of the dual space to T. It is not a vector in the sense that it is not a tangent vector. It is not defined via a tangent to a curve. Omega is defined as a map from the space of tangent vectors into the reals. It is a very distinct mathematical object. Only once we have a metric and can identify indices upstairs with indices downstairs or vectors with covectors, only then can we think of the two objects as being equivalent. So from a mathematical perspective, they're quite distinctive. One is defined as a tangent to a curve. That has a particular set of geometric baggage along with it. You're thinking of an arrow, definitely an arrow as you're moving through your manifold. The other is taking those arrows, and it's a map from those vectors into the reals. So even if that doesn't have a sort of intuitive meaning at the moment, at least you can see that the way they're defined is different. So in the end, you can think of, for example, a covector as being something which is, it's not really normal, but it's like if you have a sort of function on your manifold, you can take surfaces of F equals constant. Yep. And so locally, if you think about surfaces of F equals constant, locally that's giving you a little set, like a sheaf of paper. Yep. And so your covector is something which is telling you, you can think of it as a normal through these sort of surfaces of constant F. It is actually distinct geometrically, but it's one of those things that you kind of slowly, you know, build a picture of. So, I mean, I guess the best way to answer that at the moment is they've been defined quite distinctly. I do not have a metric yet, so I can't take EB and EA and give you a scalar. I can't do that. at least not from the perspective of the manifold.
I've seen in a textbook, can't remember which one, that defined, that defined as dy xA by dy xB. I'm just wondering if there's any use for having one or the other.
Oh, yeah, so in fact, I probably should kind of wrap all this up together. So this is the general definition. So if you're doing with a coordinate basis, your omegas would be this, dx mu. And we'll be talking a bit more tomorrow about what that means. And so you would then sort of say dx mu. Well, I do mean that, actually. And d by dx nu would then be dx mu by dx nu, which is delta mu nu. So this is coming to this notion that I was just saying about functions and the covectors as being normal to functions. Here, this thing here is really saying, you know, x mu equals constant, and it's kind of, you know, telling you how x mu changes. So just to finish off, let's just quickly, having got this expression here, I just want to note about coordinate transformations. So we said that our C infinity manifold is something where if we have an overlap of charts, that you've got an infinitely differentiable sort of transformation between the two choices. So if I have this function t, I can represent it as t mu d by dx mu, and that's the same as t nu, let me call it nu primed, d by dy nu primed. So these two have to be the same, but of course, I know that I've chosen, I've got a C infinity manifold, so these coordinate functions have to be infinitely differentiable. So I can write this. And then from this, that tells me that T mu is dx mu by dy nu t nu. So that is the contravariant coordinate transformation. And so that was perhaps, that's often the first way that you meet a definition of a vector. So I will leave it as an exercise for you to confirm that mu alpha is going to be dy beta by dx alpha mu beta, the covariant transformation rules. So we've started today by looking at what we mean by a curved spacetime. A curved spacetime is defined mathematically as a manifold, and I've obviously not really done this in a, you know, in a proper mathematical way, but I've tried to sort of show how a pure mathematician would come along and define things like vectors or covectors. And so what you want to do is to construct things which are, or definitions which are geometric and capture what our intuition is for the various objects. So a vector, which is like something with length and direction, we've changed that into a tangent vector. And tangent vectors, we've seen, have all the right properties. They form space at a point. We've also seen that, in fact, tangent spaces at different points in the manifold are not the same. They're isomorphic, but they're not the same. So they're different spaces. And so we could think of that as saying our arrow, where the root of the arrow is somewhere else. So we're going to see tomorrow one implication of that when we're trying to do differentiation. We've also done the dual space. And again, we've not done this via coordinate transformations, though we've shown that, in fact, these definitions give you exactly the same familiar covariant and contravariant coordinate transformation definitions. But we've come around from a very different direction. And so the cotangent space, we define it in such a way that you don't need a metric, you don't need a distance function to actually see what these things are. They still have, they're well defined, and they have a meaning. So tomorrow, we'll look at differentiation. I know you've already done covariant differentiation. I'm not sure if you've done exterior differentiation in the Lie derivative, but these are the sort of three main ways of differentiating on a manifold. So we'll look at those. And starting off basically by saying, if we try and be too naive about differentiation, what goes wrong? So we'll be confronting this idea that things simply don't just all collapse onto one tangent space for the whole manifold. Okay.